From the Sky News Centre at 5. Seven men from across England who ran a global child abuse network have been jailed for a total of 78 years. 24 children are now under protection, but police fear some victims are still to be identified. Tim Jones reports.
The gang planned attacks on young children and streamed it online. Andrew Quinn is from the National Crime Agency.
The judge talked about this being your worst ever nightmare. It does actually make me feel physically sick, as the judge suggested.
And child protection advisor Jessica Willits says viewing the horrific images has taken its toll.
Doing that on a daily basis in relation to this operation has been very difficult for both myself and colleagues.
The judge at Bristol Crown Court said the gang were evil beyond rational understanding.
MPs have overwhelmingly rejected plans to allow some terminally ill people to ask for medical help to end their life. Safeguards included the involvement of two doctors and a judge. Opponents feared it might have left elderly people feeling under pressure. A man's been jailed for life after launching a racially motivated attack, claiming it was in revenge for the death of British soldier Lee Rigby. Zach Davis from Mould in North Wales was told he'll serve at least 14 years behind bars after targeting a dentist with a machete and a hammer. Labour has chosen Sadiq Khan to contest next May's election for a new Mayor of London. The Tooting MP saw off competition from Dame Tessa Jowell with almost 59% of the vote after a five-round process. David Cameron says a comment he made about people in Yorkshire hating everyone was intended as a joke. The PM's remark was picked up on a microphone just before a speech he made in Leeds.
We just thought people in Yorkshire hated everyone else. We didn't realise they hate each other so much.
The PM says he expects to be getting a bit of jip about the comments. Some people on Twitter have already called him arrogant and toffee-nosed. That's the latest. I'm Andy Hayes.
Celebrating diversity, this is Bristol's BCFM.
It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock again. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is Lib Dem councillor for Whitchurch Park, and he's the Lib Dem party whip too, Tim Kent. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, we can't let September the 11th go by without taking another pop at the official conspiracy theory we're all supposed to believe, of it all being down to Bin Laden from his cave in Afghanistan. Also, the Crown Prosecution Service, who are they and what do they do? Tonight we're joined by Barry Hughes, Chief Crown Prosecutor for the South West, to ask him just that. Also, the Russians are in Syria and want to help us to destroy ISIS. After a year of us supposedly fighting ISIS, while ISIS only gets bigger and more powerful, who can blame them? Also, some believe he was one of the instigators of the 9/11 attacks, but he just happened to be hanging around the BBC's London studios ready to go live on air on September the 11th, 2001. We hear former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak on 9/11 itself on BBC World before planes had even crashed into the World Trade Centre. Plus, from last week, the one airliner that was allowed to leave otherwise closed US airspace on the afternoon of the 9/11 attacks. Who was on it and where was it heading? And Nazis in South America running what was effectively a small country in the foothills of Chile's Andes Mountains, while nourished and protected by Margaret Thatcher's friend, General Pinochet. We hear all about Colonia Dignidad, run by Nazi Paul Schaefer until his arrest in 2005, from one of the people who helped shut this Nazi stronghold down. Plus, Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 16 Celsius and showers. This weekend, highs of 18 Celsius, brighter on Saturday, some showers on Sunday, and generally breezy throughout the weekend. Next week, highs up a little bit to 18 Celsius. Plenty of wet and windy weather, though, this week, and also some sunny spells. Next weekend, that's the 19th and 20th of December. Sorry, 90th of December, really. No, the 19th and 20th of September. Highs of 18 Celsius, sunny spells and occasional showers. That was Bristol's slightly oblique two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, helping us review this week's news, hopefully doing better than I just did, is Lib Dem councillor for Whitchurch Park and party whip Tim Kent. Hi, Tim. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Good afternoon, Tony.
First of all, party whip, you are Lib Dems. How many Lib Dems have you got left? Because they seem to be falling like flies over the last couple of elections.
It's definitely a difficult job. There's a good nine of us.
Well, it's easier, isn't it, if there's less councillors to keep in line?
Not with the Lib Dems. So nine Lib Dems means I've always got at least 10 different opinions in the room.
So what do the Lib Dems stand for? I think people are starting to wonder this now. You're not part of the coalition government in Westminster. You propped up the Conservatives during the last government and basically allowed them to do pretty much what they wanted.
Well, I would disagree with that. I think actually what we've seen over the last few months is exactly what the Lib Dems were stopping the Conservatives from doing. I'm afraid that was a slightly empty message during the general election. People voted for a Conservative government. What do the Lib Dems stand for? Well, they stand for what they've always stood, which is liberty, freedom, trying to make sure people can get on with their lives, but there's a safety net there. Let's remember, it's the Liberals that invented the welfare state. It's the Liberals that put forward the report which brought in the NHS. And it's the Liberals today which are standing up and saying we must do more to help the refugees that are coming to Europe, where the current government is doing all it can to resist helping refugees. Well, so I think that's an important voice within British politics.
What about the last government, though, from 2010 to May this year? Can you actually point to anything and say, hey, the Lib Dems achieved this?
Yeah, there's quite a few things. The first thing we did was we raised the allowance for everybody in the country when they started paying tax. And for those who were earning the least, that was the most effect. So what we saw was an extra £2,000 put onto the allowances for everybody. That's about £800 back into workers' pockets. We brought in free school meals for every infant age child in this country. That's had a real positive effect. If you talk to primary school teachers, they'll say that has been a good initiative and one I hope this current government doesn't scrap. We brought in lots of other initiatives as well.
Well, you brought in tuition fees, didn't you? And all loads of young people feel totally betrayed by you guys because they voted for you saying, well, we're going to get rid of tuition fees, and you did totally the opposite. So you can't be surprised when you did so badly in the last general election.
It's certainly true. The Conservatives brought in tuition fees. Unfortunately, there were only 50-odd Liberal Democrat MPs elected to Parliament out of the 650. The other 600 were elected on a platform of increasing tuition fees. So tuition fees were increased. I oppose that, but that's what happened. And yet we were not successful in stopping the increase in tuition fees. But what we did do is what we brought in was millions of pounds extra into primary schools through our pupil premium. And what that meant, those primary schools in the poorest areas where the poorest pupils got a lot more money. And that's had a real effect on the education for our primary schools. And we will see that now come through our whole system. Okay. So I think we brought a great deal of change during a very, very difficult time when there was not much money around in the system.
Okay, let's get back to here and now. What are you achieving now here in the city in Bristol as local councillors?
Well, as local councillors, our first and foremost duty is to that of our residents and our areas, and a lot of us, that's what our day job is. But one of the key issues, as you know, we're raising at the moment is we want to allow the residents of Bristol a future referendum on whether they have a mayor or not. So here in Bristol, we're the only city in England which can never make a choice on that again. In every other part of the country, you can choose whether you want to have a mayor or not, but not in Bristol.
Okay, Tim, when are we going to get that vote, another vote to decide whether we want to continue with the mayor?
Well, the good news is Baroness Jank, former leader of Bristol City Council, put in an amendment to a government bill, and to the government's shock, actually got the votes for it in the House of Lords. So at the moment, there is a piece of legislation going through Parliament which would allow Bristol that right to hold a referendum again.
But when? If this all works out, when are we going to get that chance?
If that goes through, and if Tory MPs don't throw it out, that means the earliest chance you could have a future referendum on that is 2017.
Well, that's quite a long time in the future, isn't it? I feel a bit downhearted now. I thought we were going to get another chance at this because, the actual turnout in the referendum for mayor was pretty low, wasn't it? And although George has effectively got his mandate, he's managed to get through. A lot of people say he hasn't got actually enough backing, really.
Well, I mean, the turnout in the referendum was very, very low. And a lot of people I talked to said to me, we didn't support the idea, so we didn't turn out to vote. Unfortunately, you needed to turn out to vote and say no. Now, what they didn't realise is they would never, ever, ever get a future decision on that. That's what we're trying to restore. If we do restore that right, there is still other legislation which says you have to give it 5 years before you can have another referendum. That's why the earliest a referendum could be is 2017. I think that's fair enough. It gives a chance potentially for another mayor to come in, for people to see them operating and not make a judgment on perhaps one on the way one mayor has operated, but then they can make an actual judgment on how the system operates.
Let's widen the debate a little bit now to look at the situation with the Chief Constable, because this really is a running sore. Certainly some democratic wise, it seems to me, you've had a judge say effectively to sue Matt Stevens, the Police and Crime Commissioner, he's not done anything worthy of sacking, give him his job back, and she's saying no. And I took the trouble to print out, to go onto the Police and Crime Commissioner, Avon Police and Somerset Police and Crime Commissioner website, and print out this document here. Nick Gargan, misconduct proceedings, proven charges and findings from the misconduct panel hearing, which concluded on the 9th of July 2015. And flicking through here, Tim, I see absolutely nothing which in the vaguest way should really be any kind of grounds for dismissing the guy. It's lots of accusations of gross misconduct which have been reduced to finding misconduct, and that almost all of them are to do with an email that's been sent to somebody that they say it shouldn't have been sent to, and yet nobody in the public is allowed to know who those people are. I mean, for example, the Chief Constable could have sent an email to his solicitor or something from his police email address, and then it looks to me as if what they're saying is you should have sent this from your personal address. Effectively, both Sue and Nick were appointed on this whole thing of more openness, more accountability of the police, because the way Colin Port previously ran it was much more almost like his own, I hate to say it, but he's kind of his private fiefdom. You know, there was there were some serious accusations. I mean, he for example had high court bailiffs come to his house, say, well, you're doing investigations, you're seizing people's computers in other part of the country, and you're not having absolutely no right to do that. And if you don't give them back immediately, you yourself are going to go to jail. So that was the previous Chief Constable, Colin Port, and yet this new broom seems to have been stopped. What I'm concerned about is whether or not this guy is actually going to get his job, because the judge has said he should have it back.
Well, as you know, pretty much all the power is in the hands of one person here, which is the Police Commissioner Sue Mount-Stevens. There is a sort of a policing overwatch board where there are a few Bristol City Councillors that sit on that. They have very little power, it's got to be said, over the Police Commissioner. I think the Police Commissioner has to come clean on this. There's been a lot of accusation, a lot of innuendo, a lot of rumour. But as you say, what the Chief Constable was actually found guilty of were quite minor offences from what we can tell. They do not sound like sacking offences, and hundreds of thousands of pounds of public money has already been spent on this. This is money which could have gone into frontline policing. And I understand that obviously the police force is becoming paralysed by this conflict between our police commissioner and our chief of police. I think what we would like to see as councillors is a resolution of this. If there are good grounds for his dismissal, they need to be made clear publicly. If not, we need to put this to bed and actually get on with policing. And that's what people want to see.
I mean, one of the findings, for example, by an email exchange between you and a PCSO in August 2013, you exchanged views on the PCSO's behaviour, and you forwarded this said message to X. Well, we're not allowed to know who he's forwarded it to. It could be somewhere else internally within the police. It could be possibly to a solicitor and whatever. But then they said your said conduct amounts to gross misconduct. And then they say, no, this isn't gross misconduct. This is ordinary misconduct. So anyway, I think that there's a bigger thing going on here, Tim, where you've got an establishment police. We're talking about, you know, sort of senior retired officers who are trying to stop this guy doing his job. And the other thing is, last week I asked Sue Mount-Stevens if she could come on and, you know, help us understand what's going on here, why she's taken her view. Apparently she's on her way on leave, so I'll have to keep trying to get her back, which seems a bit of a shame that as soon as this announcement's made about that we are going to try and sack the Chief Constable, off she goes on holiday, you know. So I'm a bit disappointed. But anyway, we will keep plugging away at that one. Martin, what do you make of this? I know we keep discussing it week after week, but I'd like to see this guy get his job back. It's clearly what the judges said he wants to happen here. And the Avon and Somerset establishment don't seem to want that.
Well, all I will say is that the idea of electing police commissioners was a bad idea from the get-go. Just a silly idea. One of the bad things that the coalition did, even whatever you may say about the good things that they did. It was a silly idea. And as we've seen in the collapse of the power-sharing executive in Northern Ireland over the last week, they never introduced electing police commissioners in Northern Ireland. It would have been a disaster. So we're going to have a Republican police commissioner or a Loyalist police commissioner. And, of course, what you're trying to do is establish a situation where both communities trust the police and they're not politicised. And this was a back-of-the-envelope idea from the United States.
But we elect police commissioners in the United States. Why don't you do it in Britain?
Because we've had a terrorist civil war in Britain, for example, and the way we run things is different.
Can I point something out? It doesn't work in the United States.
Well, it doesn't work in the United States.
Yeah.
Yes, because in actual fact, really. I mean, the British tradition is that things like the police and the civil service should be depoliticised, not politicised. And frankly, Sue Mount-Stevens, nice as she is way out of her depth here. As I said last week, losing one chief constable could be an accident. Losing two is carelessness. And of course, ordinary police officers are rolling their eyes because it's actually, you know, it's like the Keystone Cops.
Well, it's bad for morale and it's paralysis at the top. Let's just let...
And also all the money wasted on all of this as well, as you pointed out.
Let this guy get on and do his job, please. One person that isn't a great fan of the police, I spoke to earlier this week. It was quite a heart-rending interview, actually, because he's homeless. He's a security guard. He was made homeless. He's actually got quite a lot of cash, but because he's unemployed and homeless and living in his car, he's found it absolutely impossible to get anywhere to live. Every private landlord that he goes to says, well, if you're on benefits, I'm afraid you can't stay here. So even though he's got enough to pay almost a year's rent up front, they haven't let him find anywhere to live. And he's still, after the 6 months, been living in his car and having a few problems with the police. But anyway, let's have a listen now to Ian, who's this homeless security guard. Who can't get a flat. And he came on the radio, really, to encourage others. When you're homeless and in this situation, don't give up. Say if you had the top job, you were Prime Minister, how would you change things?
I'd prioritise on solving the UK's problems first, and then other problems second. We can invite 20,000 Syrians into the country, but all they're doing is they're putting more pressure on a struggling health service, a struggling education system. The health service is in chaos. The Labour people moan about this, that and the other that the Conservatives have cut. Why have they cut it? Because the last government made us bankrupt. Because Gordon Brown and his cronies were too busy spending money on trivia items that we didn't really need.
Sounds to me like you might be able to get a job at Tory Central Office.
I don't think Conservatives would want me, to be honest.
No?
I'd be after David Cameron's job. And supporting Boris Johnson as the next Conservative leader. I think if the current Labour leadership goes the wrong way, and Mr Corbyn's elected, thank God we won't get a Labour government for 10 years.
Well, look, Ian, it's been absolutely fascinating chatting with you. Thanks very much for bearing your soul. It's not the easiest thing to do when you're in the kind of situation
where you are. No, but I hope people who are homeless don't give up.
Have you ever felt like...
Yes. I actually drove up to where the Clifton Down Bridge is and I sat there and I thought, one of these nights I'm going to come up here, I'm going to walk to the middle of the bridge and I'm going to jump, because I cannot see a future under Mayor Ferguson's leadership. I think Mayor Ferguson is doing more damage to the city of Bristol than he is good. I don't think an elected mayor is what Bristol needs. I think it works in London, it works in Manchester because of their bigger cities. I don't think Bristol needs an elected mayor like Mayor Ferguson. I don't think Mayor Ferguson works.
What made you decide not to? What made you decide that I'm going to stick it out and carry on even though it's tough?
I got a phone call from a friend.
Well, thank God for that phone call, Ian, eh?
Yeah.
That was homeless man Ian, who's a former security guard living in his car, really saying some pretty frightening things about how he came quite close to ending it all. I mean, he's putting this really at Mayor Ferguson's door, really for the simple fact that the council simply cannot house homeless people anymore, Tim.
Well, we do have a massive waiting list, but I've got to say, anyone who is homeless, we do have a duty to help. If you want to pass on my contact details to Ian, I can't guarantee, but I will certainly do my best to help him.
What he's saying is basically single men like him, even though he's on the edge of being disabled, or he's been, you know, he's got a very bad leg, that sort of thing. He's not eligible. He's tried to get some housing from the council, just they won't give him anything.
Well, I certainly know in the last few years other single men who have managed to get housing. I think we can help him. If he contacts me, I will do my best to help him. Certainly living in your car is no one should have to suffer that. There are options and there are ways we'll be able to help. So if you pass my details to Ian, I will make sure either I myself or another councillor will be in contact with him, and we'll do our best to make sure we find him somewhere to live.
That's great. I certainly will do that. But if you drive up to any evening, sort of 9, 10 o'clock up on the Downs, you can see a whole load of people sleeping in their cars who are having to live up there.
And the worrying thing also is young people who are homeless. I mean, there was recently a documentary about this just a few months ago, and it was surprising. 16, 17-year-olds who are sleeping homeless, sleeping in caves up at the Downs. We do know that we have a housing crisis. We do know that some of the punitive measures by the government, of whichever colour, has meant that people have been forced out of homes and made homeless by sanctions. What we need to do is make sure we've got a flexible enough system that we can actually find people homes straight away. And I do know that the council does have temporary accommodation that we can use, but also there are other ways in which we might be able to help him.
Also, in the Bristol Post yesterday, there was De Courcy House in St Paul's, just on the edge of St Paul's and Stokes Croft. That was housing. It was a former probation service building, housing 60 people. This week, they've all been thrown out onto the streets. Where are they supposed to go?
I mean, it is the problem, of course, where people are occupying a building without the legal tenancy to do that. What we actually need, though, is far more cheap, affordable and flexible accommodation, particularly for younger people.
Where are those 60 people going to be spending the night tonight, Tim?
Well, that's true, and some of them will be spending it on the streets. It is a fair point, and I certainly don't have an answer to all of that. What I do know is that if there's someone like Ian, don't give up. Do get in contact with a local councillor. In the main, whatever party or political hue a councillor is, they will do their best to help you. And at least you'll have someone there fighting your corner with the council, but also maybe with other private operators. Certainly in the past, I've had a resident who was homeless sleeping on a building site. 4 hours later, I had them in temporary housing accommodation by simply just phoning up a private provider, getting her an interview and getting her into that accommodation that night. So there are other ways that we can potentially help as well.
Martin, what Ian's saying and many other people are saying is if you're actually on benefits, you cannot get private rented accommodation anymore. It's a bit almost impossible. Well, he's saying he's got enough savings to maybe pay even a year's rent up front.
Yeah,
still,
well,
no one will rent to him.
To be honest with you, I was caught in this trap 2 years ago myself. Ian Duncan Smith's decision to pay what they're going to do with universal credit is that instead of rent being paid directly to landlords, it will be paid to tenants who will then pay the landlords. And it's all part of this nanny state idea that we're going to teach people how to budget. In actual fact, of course, what then happened is a big Tory donor in the southeast of England, who's one of the biggest buy-to-letters in the country, then said, well, on that basis, I am not going to rent anybody on benefits. Not only am I not going to rent any new people on benefits, the existing people in my houses, I'm going to kick them out, and I want East Europeans who are working to have those rooms. I mean, he's a Tory donor who said this. Now, in other words, this is just an administrative decision by Ian Duncan Smith. In the past, there was a definite section of the private rented market which was for those on benefits, and the landlords concerned knew what the deal was. They knew that they were not going to get loads of money out of these people compared to sort of yuppies and what have you, but on the other hand, it was guaranteed money and it went directly into their accounts, and on that basis they were prepared to take people on benefits. Changing the regulations means that no I went to a private rented accommodation place around here, and as soon as I said that I was on benefits, they said, well, we can't help you. So I then went to the next one and I lied. And on the basis of that, I then was able to worm my way into the system,
look, Martin,
and so on.
Ian's argument is, I'm a security guard. If I'm caught lying, it could jeopardise my prospects of getting
a
job.
Yes, the point is that we should never... The point I'm getting to, it's repetition, Ian Duncan Smith's changing the regulations is absolutely stupid and is actually creating... There is already a crisis because we haven't got enough affordable housing, as Tim's pointed out, and that's been going on for years. We had 13 years of Labour government where they sat on their hands. But now, of course, but this just tweaking the regulations to say that private landlords could have their money paid directly from tenants would actually ease the situation for people like Ian. Because then private landlords would say, OK, you're a reasonable bet, especially if you've got money to put down. But the regulations have been changed. But part of this stupid social engineering idea that IDS has got, that poor people need to be taught how to budget, so we're going to give them all their money in one pot, and then they've got to decide how to spend it. And you feel like saying, these are vulnerable people. They've got mental health issues, drug and alcohol problems. Well, you really just want to give them money to spend?
There's another side of this. We've also heard that Ian Duncan Smith wants to force a million disabled people into work. Now, where are these jobs going to come from? There's even existing people, there's not enough jobs to go around.
Well, if in Cuba, of course, what happens is that everybody...
Not in Cuba. No, but just a minute, we're not in Cuba. Tim, what are your thoughts about a million disabled people have got to get work, according to Ian Duncan Smith?
Well, Ian Duncan Smith comes out with lots of ideas which might sound good around the cabinet table, but in real life, practical life, we know that that is not the case. We know that businesses are always going to try to get the most out of their employees, and it's always going to be an unfair job market for disabled people. That doesn't mean that the vast majority of disabled people aren't capable and shouldn't work, but what we've got to do is actually make sure that there's an even playing field if that is the case. That means helping employers and helping those people get those jobs, maintain those jobs, and be able to fund those jobs. And I do think that over the last few years, what we've seen is a reduction down on helping disabled people into work and maintaining that work, and just setting
targets. That's just not true, is it? We've kicked them out. We've closed down Remploy, which was looking after disabled people right across the country as part of a government which the Lib Dems were part of.
Well, I'm not disagreeing. I'm saying I think there has been a reduction in benefits and help to disabled people, and simply setting a target of 1 million disabled people getting back into work is not realistic if we don't make sure the support mechanisms aren't there. I have no problem at all with the idea of disabled people working alongside able-bodied people. I think that is the ideal. But I think what we've got to do is make sure we've got the support there for the disabled people as well as the employers to make that idea a reality.
It's all very well if the jobs are there and the jobs are paying decent wages and people will take them, won't they? Anyway, you can hear more of that interview with Ian on our sister show Dialect, which is on Tuesday at noon. But let's go to good old Prime Minister's Questions is back. And the subject of sickness benefit came up with a question raised by Libby Abrahams this week.
Libby Abrahams.
2 weeks ago, the Work and Pensions Secretary's department not only admitted to falsifying testimonies in leaflet, but they also published data on the deaths of people on sickness benefit, which showed that they are four times more likely to die than the general population. Yeah. This was after the Secretary of State told this House that these data did not exist. Given this, and his offensive remarks earlier this week, referring to people without disabilities as normal, when will the Prime Minister take control and respond to my call for the Work and Pensions Secretary to be investigated for breaching the ministerial code?
Well, first of all, let me deal very directly with the publication of this data. This data was published because I promised at this dispatch box it would be published in a way that it was never published under any Labour government. That is the first point. And I also think we should be clear about what this data shows. It does not show people wrongly being assessed as fit to work. It does not show people dying as a result of their benefits taken away. If you listen to the organisation Full Fact, they said this. I have to say to Honourable Gentleman, two newspapers have printed that fact and had to retract it. So I think actually people should look at out the facts. And the fact-checking organisation says this: it was widely reported that thousands of people died within weeks of being found fit for work and losing their benefits. This is wrong. Perhaps you should read that before asking our next question.
Well, that's very weasel words from the Prime Minister, isn't it? I think most people understand that if people are found fit for work and then they die within 2 weeks of being found fit for work, it's most unlikely that the decision that found them fit for work was right. And I would just make like a further point. Nobody but a doctor should decide whether somebody is fit for work. Half-trained ATOS employees are not sufficient people to decide who is and who is not fit
especially
for work.
Especially if they're on a bonus for the more people they kick off the benefits.
Indeed. And this is another example of IDS and his ideological approach to these issues. I was going to say, in Cuba, disabled people are made to work. Everybody has to work. It's a full employment society because they say, right, you are running such and such a company, you will take 20 disabled people because everybody works in Cuba. But we have a free market economy here. Which employer is going to take a disabled person? And of course, we could get rid of a free market economy and give everybody a job. But I understand the Conservatives seem to be in favour of a free market economy. Perhaps they'd like to say which employers should take these disabled people and how are they going to make them?
Tim, what are your thoughts about this shocking figure, these thousands of people who died within 2 weeks of being found fit for work?
Well, I think a lot of people have concerns about how ATOS have been carrying out assessments of people. I was talking with a resident of mine recently who a few years ago went for an ATOS assessment, was found fit for work, and when he called his consultant about it, because he was still under medical care, his consultant was so angry that he immediately actually gave him a 12-month sick note, signing him off until he actually hit retirement, and simply said ATOS did not know what they were talking about. So he used the system against ATOS. But I think the government does need to have a rethink about how they're actually assessing people. I agree, only doctors should make such a medical judgment, and the fact that non-doctors have been used is just not acceptable.
Do you think this is legally challengeable in the courts? If someone who doesn't know what they're doing, who's being bribed to say one thing and not something else, says that you're fit for work when you're not, surely someone could challenge that legally.
Well, one would hope so, but of course, weak people, poor people, don't have that kind of clout, do they?
And especially with the withdrawal of legal aid.
Yeah. Well, I understand, actually. I thought some Bristol University students had challenged recently a load of ATOS decisions, and they won 95% of the cases they challenged, which is quite a remarkable win rate. Firstly, that puts a lot of doubt into ATOS. Secondly, if I was any solicitors for them, I'd immediately employ those students.
Well, also, it does imply that the government's taking advantage of the fact that these people are poor, and they've also taken away their access to justice, Tim.
Yes, I agree.
Well, I agree, obviously.
Okay, all right, another story. Ex-Clifton College teachers jailed for secret filming at boarding school. This is the BBC here. Former teachers jailed after admitting making indecent films. More than 120 pupils using hidden cameras at a boarding school. Jonathan Thompson Glover, 53, of Wadebridge, pleaded guilty to making the films at Clifton College, Bristol, and also at an address in Cornwall. Tim, this is pretty shocking. It's last week's news, which we missed, actually, from the 27th of August. But this Clifton College, I thought, was supposed to be quite a reasonable establishment, and this guy's been caught out before, hasn't he? I think he was found tied to a chair. Also, one parent has written to the Bristol Post saying that she has made complaints to the school about this guy years ago.
Well, obviously, it's up to the college to explain why they didn't act properly when those complaints were made. But what we also see here is the challenge of modern technology and the idea that, obviously, paedophiles, we know in the past, have targeted access to children, so becoming teachers, joining scout groups. Now what we're seeing is they can also use modern technology as well, and what we need to make sure is that our systems in schools and our child protection policies are firm enough and have been updated enough, and the practices people employ are there to make sure people can't get away with this. So we do need to make sure our schools are very much thinking about the what ifs and not just reacting when these cases happen.
We've got two occasions where this guy has been, we know about, and is probably many more, that he's been brought to the attention of the headmaster and other authorities in the school, Martin, and yet this guy was still able to carry on both filming kids at the school, filming them at his home, and also taking his favourite children away on little holidays in to Cornwall with him.
Well, I think, as Tim said, the fact is that this came to light some time ago, and Clifton College should have acted on the information that they had, and they haven't. So that's the main take-home for me from this. And, you know, I work in a school, and we're not allowed to use phones, for example, around the children at all. If you want to use your mobile phone, you have to go out of the school and off the premises.
Well, I'm also joined by education expert Christine Townsend. Hi, Christine.
Hello.
I don't know if maybe you'd like to comment on this, because this does seem a complete collapse rather than just a one or two mistakes of any kind of real oversight up at Clifton College as to looking after the children.
I've been following this, and there was a link on the BBC website to a report, a one-day unannounced report that was done last July. So presumably this was at a time when they knew what this man was doing, and that was on behalf of the Department of Education. Now that inspectorate report is pretty damning in all areas when it comes to safeguarding. But what's even more disturbing actually is the Independent Schools Inspectorate had been into that school previous to that, and they'd come out with a good. So the question I'm now asking is, okay, how is it that you can get a good and then a couple of years later they're failing in all areas? Somebody somewhere is not looking at safeguarding in the way that they need to be looking at and at the depth in which they need to be looking at. And presumably the school didn't raise and bring to the attention of the inspectorate when they went in the issues that had been raised internally. I mean, there are some serious questions to be answered by this school, but also the local safeguarding board need to take this on as well, because if it's happening in Clifton College, what's going on in the other independent schools? That's the question I'm asking.
Absolutely. Why has the headmaster, principal, board not been sacked for this?
Well, I mean, if this was going on in a state school, heads would have rolled by now easily. As far as I'm aware, the school, nobody from the school has made comment in any way into the media. They've just put out bland statements about how they're looking into things.
We apologise, we regret, blah blah blah, but they're all still in their jobs, aren't they?
Yeah, everybody's in their jobs, as far as I'm aware. The governing body is still in place. I'm interested to know, okay, these people on the governing bodies, are they involved in other schools anywhere else in the country? Are they involved in running any other kind of services for young people? There are serious investigations and questions that need to be answered around this.
Martin, it does make me think of the wider VI paedophile scandal, where it almost seems that this kind of behaviour amongst an elite is kind of acceptable, because there's some kind of effectively kind of political blackmail going on, and it's seen as something which is acceptable amongst a certain elite.
Well, I mean, there are wider questions about VIP paedophilia. For example, the King Cora Boys Home in Northern Ireland, which was not going to be originally included in the investigation, but now is, on the grounds that it was not part of British jurisdiction, which is quite interesting considering the position of the Republicans on this.
Can you just explain, though, why an elite, whether it's in Bristol or in Westminster or anywhere in the country, would actually turn a blind eye to paedophilia?
Well, you've got the culture of single-sex schools, which goes back to the 19th century. We all know about that.
Isn't this a mixed sex school?
It is now, yes. I mean, originally it would have been single sex.
More to the point, if we're going to talk about the VIP paedophile scandal, is the King Cora Boys Home, which is what Ken Livingstone made his maiden speech in the House of Commons about many years ago. And it's very clear in Northern Ireland, across the political spectrum, that the King Cora Boys Home was being used by MI5 as a honey trap. So they basically inveigled various politicians and paramilitary leaders into King Cora Boys Home to have sex with boys underage, and videoed the whole lot so that they could then use that against the various political figures that they were trying to blackmail. That is the bottom line, and I'm afraid the investigation of King Cora will show, if it's carried out thoroughly by the PSNI, that the British intelligence services have used paedophilia as a form of blackmail, and that's what I think is the heart of the VIP paedophile conspiracy in Britain. I mean, it's been used as a blackmail tool by the intelligence services for decades,
which may be why it's seen in some circles as acceptable in inverted commas. Well, look, Christine, what I can't understand about this is how parents reporting that this teacher Jonathan Thompson Glover, was regularly, or from time to time, he was taking pupils, selected his favourite selected pupils off on holiday with him on his own down to Cornwall. That's not normal behaviour, surely?
No, that would be absolutely out of the question for anybody within a state school to have that kind of...
So why is it acceptable in
Well, it isn't. I mean, I would say that it isn't, and I'm shocked that that is that was practice that was clearly going on until this unannounced day of inspection, because it's actually mentioned in there that there's a lack of policy, there's a lack of procedures around children entering into staff accommodation. I mean, I think really it goes back to this. Well, they're all nice chaps, aren't they? And they won't do that kind of thing. And if they do, then somehow it's the child's fault. And if we just pretend it hasn't happened, then it all goes away. The problem is in no one's interests. In terms of who goes to the college, who runs the college, possibly the future of those children, it's in no one's interest for this to come out. This is huge. This is going to run and run and run, this particular case, and the ramifications for Clifton College and across the independent sector in Bristol and possibly beyond is going to be massive.
Well, I hope so. I do equate this with bullying. I mean, over the years, I've reported on lots of cases of bullying at school. I remember one down, very particularly memorable, down in Salisbury when I was working for the BBC down there. When a kid was strung up by some of his fellow pupils on some railings and actually murdered, and the school did everything they could possible to cover it up. So I wonder if maybe that's the sort of thing that's going on up at Clifton College.
Well, hopefully, the investigations that are going on will discover this, and I want to see that public, and I want to see it published.
And let's have a few rather more realistic comments from the trustees up at Clifton College. Tim, what do you make of this? Because I know this is at an oblique angle. You've been talking about school places as well this week.
Yes, I mean, what we're actually discussing at the council next week is the issue of secondary school places. As we all know, we had a primary school place crisis about 5 or 6 years ago here in Bristol. Well, not surprisingly now, those children are moving through the system, and by 2017, we will actually see them coming into our secondary schools. What we haven't yet done is put the groundwork in place to make sure we've expanded the classrooms for those children. So the issue we're debating next week is, can we have a firm plan from the mayor showing us concrete proposals on how we're going to have enough places for every child in Bristol so we can satisfy parents that we won't see that same crisis again.
And now I know this is going back a few years now, but that Bristol had a terrible record in GCSE achievement, in fact one of the worst in the country. I wonder, Christine, have we seen any kind of increase? Are things getting better or not?
Well, if you look at the headline figures, they are. There's kind of GCSE results are going up year on year, and more children are choosing to, families are choosing to send their children to Bristol schools. But what we've got to look at is what lies underneath that, because we have had an expansion of our secondary school system. We've had a new school in Redland Green. We've had the free school that's been built. We've had two private schools now become state-funded academies. And when the headlines say things like parents are choosing to send their children to Bristol, well, the people that can choose are the people that are affluent, and those are the people that we see educated in those four secondary schools.
So are we still looking at selection by where you live, effectively?
And more than where you live. I mean, in Redland Green, it's done on distance. That's how they fill their places. But in schools such as Cathedral and Colston Girls, we have this random allocation across huge areas. And Colston Girls are still ring-fencing places for children that do not live in Bristol and are turning away hundreds and hundreds of Bristol families.
Tim, do you think it's okay for schools to pick and choose who they want as their pupils?
I think that's the system that has been brought in place. To a certain extent, that system has always existed. Let's remember, we've got the Catholic and the Church of England schools. They've always picked who would actually come into their schools. So we've always had a system which has different admissions policies. The key thing, though, for me is that if you wish, you should be able to send your child to your local secondary school. And by 2017, what we know is that we will face a real problem in being able to achieve that across the city. We will probably just have enough school places for kids. What we won't have is have them in the right area. So we need to make sure that we have plans to expand our school places, that we have fair admissions policies, and that we also have a plan for delivering those extra places. Because by 2023, we have to have built an extra 35 classrooms. That's 35 entry classrooms in total, somewhere in the region of 175 classrooms to deal with the primary school places. And it is true that a lot more parents are choosing to send their children to Bristol schools. That's great. That's also part of the problem we now face. We have to make sure we've got the classrooms for them to be able to send their kids to.
Okay, well, fingers crossed. Clifton College, is there a connection with the Merchant Venturers, Christine?
Well, I found one person on the list that I've cross-referenced
one of
with
their, one of their trustees.
One of their trustees. What's most interesting, though, about the people who run this school is that the vast majority of them went to the school. The teacher we're talking about went to the school. His father was a priest who worked at the school. So the connection, it's just the connections are just there. Very, it's just the old boy, this old boy, old tie thing going on.
Incestuous, isn't it? The poor are stupid and will suffer much. Well, that's the English translation of the Latin motto you'll find on Merchant's Hall. And Merchant Hall is open tomorrow on Open Doors Day. Probably the most interesting place you can go and have a visit on Open Doors Day. It's the home of the Merchant Venturers, who have owned Bristol for over 450 years, it says here. Paintings and historic artefacts in an imposing Victorian mansion. Bus routes 8 and 9. This is tomorrow. That's Saturday the 12th of September. Open from 10 till 4 p.m. and that's Merchants Hall, which is up on the promenade just on the edge of Clifton Downs. That's BS8 3NH. Don't miss it, and don't go to another Open Doors. Go to see the Merchant Venturers and have a little dig around. See if you can, if they're doing a tour, see if you can sort of stray away from the tour and go into one of their offices and open up some of their accounts, because the accounts are not available to the public because the Merchant Venturers are formed under a royal charter. They don't have to file reports at Company's House anyway. Christine, maybe you could just say one more thing about the extent to which the Merchant Venturers have influence now in many of our secondary schools across the city.
Oh, well, they've been around since 2008. They first came into the state sector as an organisation. So what did we see? We saw them open the Merchants Academy in the south. They also were overseeing the Bristol Cathedral Choir School, Colston Girls and the City Academy under something called the Southwest Academies Limited. Now, if you looked at their websites, though, you would think that maybe these four schools are all separate, but Southwest Academies Limited is still filing accounts to Company's House, and there are five shareholders, and it's those four secondary schools and the Merchant Venturers as an organisation. So if you know where to look and you understand the history of academisation in our city, you know that that there are these connections and that these schools are connected with each other.
Yes, and also they'll be bringing all their kids in, won't they, for their Charter Day service up at the cathedral, which they block book, and they also block book the soul of the bishop as well.
I've had an idea about that, Tony. I do think that you should invite the cathedral to do a live broadcast of the bishop's his sermon,
yeah,
so that there's no understanding on that morning about what it is that the bishop's actually saying to our children about Colston.
Yes, I mean, he just seemed to misunderstand his own sermon when he said that the Edward Colston... the idea that Edward Colston was involved in the slave trade was some kind of speculation. Now, this does sound like indoctrinating the kids in lies, and I hope he'll make some corrections in his sermon this year, Bishop Mike. Anyway, thanks very much for joining us, Christine. Fascinating. Just to remind listeners, the Open Doors Day at Merchants Hall, the promenade tomorrow, it's open from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. and that's at the promenade, BS8 3NH, part of Bristol Open Doors Day. Now Martin Summers, Old Labour Oxford economist, we must just talk briefly about the Labour leadership election, because your party is going to choose the next leader, and it's going to be announced tomorrow.
Yes, and I haven't had a ballot, which I'm still quite annoyed about. I'm one of those that has not been able to vote because I've not received my a paper or an electronic ballot. I'm hoping it's just me and that there isn't more people involved, because if there's large numbers of people who haven't been able to vote, that's going to be extremely destabilising.
Well, it's not just you, is it? There's quite a few people who have been complaining about this. Is this gerrymandering, Martin, or is it a genuine error?
Some people have been excluded on various grounds, but mostly people who joined under the recent expansion of supporters rather than members. And, you know, obviously there's going to be some dispute about that. I mean, Mark Savotka, who's the head of PCS Trade Union,
he was excluded, even though there's no evidence that he's ever voted anything other than Labour, even though the PCS isn't affiliated with the Labour Party. So there are probably going to be some rows about that. But I'm really worried that it's not just me, and lots of people have not had their ballots, and that's going to cause a lot of annoyance if that's the case.
Tim, Corbyn is the favourite. What's the implications if he is announced as the new Labour leader tomorrow?
Well, I guess what he gives Labour is a new dimension. They actually have a leader who actually believes in what he's saying, which is will be novel. But I think the problem is most of his MPs won't believe in that message. I fear that what that will mean is probably a fairly bad defeat for Labour in 2020. And actually, as a Liberal Democrat, I don't want to see that happen. As a left-of-centre individual, it is in my interest for the Labour Party to do well. Having said that, I think Jeremy Corbyn's politics are probably the politics which are in the main which I want to see in this country, but he does have a few questions around some of previous allegiances which I got a feeling the Tories will throw at him, so it will be interesting times. I think that's fair to say. I mean, we've got a new leader as well, Tim Farron, and I think you'll be seeing him here in this city this weekend.
And you've also, are you not just about to announce your candidate for the mayor election next year as well, Tim?
We're launching our mayoral candidates campaign this weekend. I mean, I don't think it's a state secret. Kay Barnard, born and bred in this city, who holds a doctorate, has been involved in politics, but at the same time has a real life. Somebody who's really intelligent, really good at bringing people together. I think she'll make a great candidate for mayor.
Yes, but
we're announcing her campaign this weekend.
But
yes.
click, can she take out Ferguson?
Well, click. No one thought George was going to win, and he did.
So I did.
Think it is an open contest. I think a lot of people are not enthused by the choices they have from the Labour Party. So I think it will be quite open, and we'll have to see.
Martin, if Corbyn is selected tomorrow, doesn't this say something about the disconnect between the Parliamentary Labour Party, that is the MPs, and the membership?
Well, yes, and as I said last week on this show, there was a split in the Labour Party in New Zealand in the early 1980s. And what happened was that the left of the party were very unhappy with the right of the parties running the government, and they went out and knocked on every door in New Zealand and forced a referendum on PR. And when Corbyn came to Bristol, I actually questioned him and I said, what is your position on PR? And his answer was not satisfactory, Tim, I have to tell you. What he said is, I want the Constitutional Convention to look at all of it. But I said, look, going with your conviction politics has got to be a commitment to change the electoral system.
It's a no-brainer, Martin. It's only an internal problem in the Labour Party. Why is it that you've got a whole bunch of MPs that are not in tune with the membership of the party?
That's exactly what happened in New Zealand. All the people that had been elected in 1980 were to the right and started, for example, they privatised the railways. They started to move in a Thatcherite direction, and the trade unions and the activists weren't going to have it. And so this has actually already been played out 30 years ago in New Zealand. And if Labour Party, you see, the Labour Party right, who didn't vote against the welfare bill. Tim Farron and the Liberal Democrats had no problem, as a left of centre party, voting against the welfare bill. Whereas all three of the Labour candidates, apart from Jeremy Corbyn, abstained. And that's going to cost them probably any chance of being the leader of the Labour Party.
Well,
apart from the fact that they all voted for the Iraq War.
Part of all of this is we say goodbye to Harriet Harman at Prime Minister's Questions, and whoever it is that wins, I imagine we'll be taking over next week. So let's have a listen to Harriet Harman this week.
Can I ask the Prime Minister about the refugee crisis? This is the largest movement of people across Europe since the Second World War. Within just 1 month, over 50,000 refugees arriving in Greece and thousands more setting off on foot to go from Hungary to Austria. The Prime Minister committed on Monday that we would accept 20,000 Syrian refugees over the next 5 years. But for these people, 2020 must seem a lifetime away. Can he tell the House how many will be allowed to come to the UK by the end of this year?
First of all, Mr. Speaker, before I answer the Right Honourable Lady's question, I'm sure the whole House will join me in paying tribute to her 28 years of front bench service as it potentially comes to an end this week. She has served with distinction in both opposition and government. Twice she stepped into the breach as her party's acting leader, never an easy job, but she's carried it out with total assurance. She's always been a robust adversary across these dispatch boxes and a fierce champion for a range of issues, most notably women's rights, where she's often led the way in changing attitudes in our country for the better. And although we haven't always seen eye to eye, she has served her constituents, her party and this House with distinction from the front bench, and I wish her well as she continues to serve this House and our country from the back benches. Turning to the specific issue she raised, she's absolutely right. This is the biggest crisis facing Europe. We have to act on all of the areas that she mentions. We have to use our head and our heart. We've committed to taking 20,000 people. I want us to get on with that. There's no limit on the amount of people that could come in the first year. Let's get on with it, but let's recognise we have to go to the camps, we have to find the people, we have to make sure they can be housed, we have to find schools for their children, we have to work with local councils and local voluntary bodies to make sure that when these people come, they get a warm welcome from Britain.
Well, it's all warm words there, but one of the key things there, Martin, is saying we have to make sure they can all be housed. Well, we've heard from this British chap earlier on who's for 6 months, he can't get housed. So how do you square this circle between, yes, we want to help these people, migrants, refugees from Syria, but how are we going to square that with actually housing people who are already here in Britain?
Well, we're not, is a simple answer, isn't it? Well, there isn't enough housing to go around, and these people will, if they do get housing, will take it from other people who won't get it. We need a crash building programme of houses.
We've got a lot of empty offices, haven't we? A lot of empty shops, actually. A lot of empty premises.
Well, we should obviously completely change our attitude towards housing. That's an obvious point to make. Can I just repeat, as I've often said on this programme, Roland Dumas, the former French foreign minister, has been on the TV in France 2 years ago now, and he said, before the Arab Spring, before anything happened in Syria, I was approached by British officials who said to me, we are going to run an armed uprising in Syria. Now, in other words, that's on the record. And I think there's no doubt about it. Across the Middle East, people know the British Special Forces have been training jihadi terrorists in both Jordan and in Turkey. And then, of course, we get upset when the results of our criminal behaviour start to cause problems for us.
Tim, how are we going to square this with refugees coming to Britain, and also we can't even house people who are already here?
Well, first off, we do have a lot of empty properties in Britain. I mean, up to around 500,000 homes sit empty, and that's disgraceful, and we do need to tackle that issue. Secondly, yes, there is pressure on housing. We do need to build more homes, and it's always a problem if no one ever wants those homes near them. But we, as politicians, we've got to show far more leadership on this and actually say, yes, we will build more homes, because actually people in their 20s and 30s can't afford homes. Putting aside the refugee issue, we need more homes in this country. There are ways we can help. Firstly, I do think actually, as moral people and a rich country, we should be willing to do more to help. That means, yes, letting more refugees in, but helping them also where they are. That means making sure they've got good supplies, but they also need hope of a future. One of the problems is a lot of these people are in camps, but they've been in camps for years. They have their children, and they need to give their children hope of a future. That's why they're coming to the West, is so they can actually give their children a future. And if we cannot offer them that future in Turkey, in Lebanon, they're going to come here. And there's 4 million refugees from Syria alone outside of the country. Inside Syria, there's another 7 million displaced people. So whatever we can do at the moment, my family, we're collecting coats, which we can send out to Turkey to help children through the winter. Anything people can do to help, whether that's donating a room, donating some money, donating some food, it's all an effort to show that we are a moral country. Well, another thing I would say, which has been a good thing, is that we do give over £1 billion so far in our foreign aid budget to helping people in camps. We should be giving more, and other countries should be giving more as well.
Okay, time now for the Murdoch News at 6. But before that, I must say, I dug up an article from April this year. Michael Portillo, Conservative former Defence Secretary, says desperate Mediterranean refugees should be dumped on a Libyan beach. Couldn't believe that in a BBC programme. Thanks to this week's guest, Lib Dem councillor of Whitchurch Park and party whip Tim Kent, and also to education expert